Our last program in the week of the Great Infamy was with Morton Kondracki of Roll Call Magazine and of cable television, and Bill Gertz of the Washington Times. They both join us by phone from Washington on Friday night to discuss our response, noting that the high casualties inflicted require that we surely take the gloves off. Here it is. And at the moment on the phone, one of the most significant journalists in Washington, Morton Kondracki. Good evening, Mort.
Hi, Milt. How are you doing?
Thanks very much for joining us. Of course, you were with us only about a week or 10 days ago here in the studio.
Right.
As a matter of fact, we played the tape that we did about your new book, about your wife and her struggle. We played that on
Monday.
On the program on Monday.
Right. Thank
Mort,
you.
We've just had on the news that directly preceded me something I had not yet seen or heard, namely an announcement that two of the people piloting these planes were trained at the American Air University and were pilots for Saudi Airlines. Are you aware of that?
No, I didn't. I wasn't aware of it until I heard it. I mean, it just goes to show you how lax our security is and how, you know, penetrable we've been. I mean, it's interesting that the Europeans today just rounded up Islamic radicals. You know, they knew who they were. They've got a totally different system of internal security from ours. I mean, they just whip people off the street if they have to. Now, I'm not sure that we're going to get to that, but I mean, it's pretty shocking that we would not have any idea of the political proclivities of somebody, you know, that was attending one of our war colleges.
Here's the direct item. I just asked our Andrea Darlis, who was reading the news a moment ago, to bring it in. Some of these terrorists clustered around Mohammed Atta, a square-jawed 33-year-old pilot who ended up on the first plane to smash into New York's World Trade Center. Atta and Marwan al-Shehi, 23, trained as pilots together in Florida and stayed together in the home of the former flight school worker. That we knew already. I'm looking for the other material about their training. I can't find it.
You know what I found very interesting?
Yeah.
There was a wonderful New York Times story about this guy, Atta. It was played way inside the paper, I think it was yesterday, about how Atta and one of the other pilots were sitting in a bar in Florida the week before the assaults on us, guzzling vodka. Now, Islamic fundamentalists are not supposed to be guzzling vodka. I mean, it makes you wonder whether they, you know, what I don't know what the consequence is, but the idea.
Well, on the other hand, if I were about to commit suicide, even for Allah, and had a week to go, I might guzzle vodka to keep my courage up too.
Well, you know, if you're a sincere Muslim fundamentalist and you think you're doing this for Allah, I don't know that you guzzle vodka, you know. I mean, I just wonder if there's not more to this story, whether there aren't hirelings or you know, they were, one of my thoughts was that maybe, you know, their families were being menaced or some other, you know, something more to the story anyway,
yeah,
than just Islamic fundamentalism.
Mort, we've got another personage from Washington on the other line, and I imagine you know Bill Gertz, don't you?
I do.
Bill Gertz from the Washington Times, their Pentagon reporter, Morton Kondracki, editor and writer for Roll Call, the twice weekly and utterly informative thing focused on congressional and governmental affairs. Also, of course, co-host of the Fox News Channel's Beltway Boys. And Bill Gertz, good evening.
Good evening, Milt.
I was just asking Mort about a news item I thought I heard a moment ago, saying that the FBI now reveals that we know of two of these terrorists who piloted the planes, that they had American training, probably at American, at the Air University. Do you know anything about that?
Yes, I've been talking to a number of officials in government about this whole case, and it does look like really you've got kind of sleeper agents here. That is, people, you know, in Cold War terms, we used to talk about agents that were sent in deep cover and then would be activated, and this is like deep cover sleeper terrorists, people that have been preparing for these missions for quite some time. It's rather chilling to think that these networks have been operating undetected, and at least for months, if not years.
Your beach is the Pentagon, and of course you've got very good access, I know, Bill. I'm always fascinated by what you have revealed first with regard particularly to our connection to China, or rather the way in which China has been served by us, at least by earlier administrations, and the sharing of advanced technology, which has aided them in the development of their ICBM force and aided them in yet other ways. But about the Pentagon itself right now, with all the contacts that you've got over there, and I'm sure Morton knows an awful lot of these people too, how injured are they by the assault that was successfully worked upon them?
Yeah, I think injured is, you know, other than feeling bad for the victims, I think there's kind of a seething anger. I really sense that in Defense Secretary Don Rumsfeld. He's got kind of a quiet anger about him in his demeanor. And the Deputy Defense Secretary, Paul Wolfowitz, also was talking about a sustained military campaign. I really sense that they're gearing up for war. The problem is there's no downtown Baghdad in this war, and that's definitely going to create some challenges.
Well, that is the basic question. I think we certainly need to take the president seriously, and we need to take Congress seriously. They're voting a war authorization bill this very night. They voted a $40 billion special budget for response in this emergency. The president says we are in war. Secretary Colin Powell says we are in war. Mort, I was just reading your column in Roll Call of, I think, about a day ago, or is it 2 days ago, mm-hmm. in which you say, yes, we are in war and we must wage this war. And you talk about how it might be waged. And I assume, Bill Gertz, you also feel not only that we have a challenge here and it is a wartime situation, but that we should go forward and fight this war and win it, as the president has said we will. But what would the nature of that war be? Mort, do you have any sense of what they're planning and how they're thinking about it?
You know, there's a debate actually underway, and I don't know about the debate inside. Bill always knows what's going on inside much better than practically any other journalist in Washington, so he may know better than I do. But on the outside, there's a debate as to whether the analogy here is Pearl Harbor, where it's all out, where it's done with all resources, or whether it's the Cold War. It's much more sustained. It's done much more slowly, much more with two steps forward, one step back. Not to say that it's not sustained, but it's not. We're not in combat all the time. I mean, some people say, and I credit this. Look, we're on a deadline here. We don't know exactly what the deadline is, but the deadline is when it is that one of these groups or one of the nations that sponsor them have deliverable chemical, biological, or nuclear capacity. Presumably, if Osama bin Laden had such capacity now, there'd be a lot more dead than the people in the World Trade Center.
Well, in all likelihood, Iraq has some such capacity. We know that they've been trying to develop it. And the thing in the hints we've had from the president and from Powell and from others as well, from Rumsfeld, I guess, is given in the statement in the president, that portion of the president's speech to the nation, and then it was repeated again even in the National Cathedral today, that we will go after those nations that not only harbor them but sponsor them, finance them, aid them, and if those nations don't change their policy, we will change the regimes in those nations. That would
right.
suggest that we've got to go in there finally and get rid of Saddam Hussein and his bunch.
If you listen to what Powell said yesterday and what Paul Wolfowitz said yesterday, we are going to go after all of it, root and branch. As soon as Powell's order of battle was, first we get the guys who did this, and then we go after everybody else. The question is, you know, what is the strategy for that?
The basic question is, how do you do it? How do you do it with regard to Saddam, the villain that the president's father, when president, hated and pursued, but would not pursue all the way to Baghdad?
Well, I mean, presumably you could. Well, one, I mean, you if you really meant it, you know, again, you would mount another desert storm if you needed to do it. I mean, another conceivable way to do it would be to bomb the Republican Guards and keep bombing them until they toppled Saddam Hussein.
Yeah.
You know, or some such thing.
Now, Bill Gertz, that's the issue before us immediately. Not how you go after the terrorists, but how you go after the nations that will not give up their sponsorship of the terrorists. What are you hearing from your Pentagon friends?
Well, I think the difference here is the issue of casualties. We've taken casualties, innocent civilians, and some military, and that is really the basis for dropping the gloves and coming out swinging. The other thing I think that will be different, and that will affect how we prosecute this war on terrorism. There's up until now, there's been a tremendous aversion in the military to taking casualties. I think that's going to change. That means that we're going to do more high-risk things, and I think one of the immediate changes will be we're going to see more use of special forces.
Going onto the ground.
Yes, in the air,
not just bombing, not just air warfare, but
highly trained, specialized anti-terrorist military personnel, people that are trained to do counter-terrorist operations.
But it can't just be the Delta Force. It obviously has to be divisions rather than squads.
Well, the problem with divisions is, I mean, that's if you're going against an Iraq, and I don't see that right away. I think the immediate problem is going to be Afghanistan. This is where bin Laden is operating. They're going to try to cut off the head and then go after the tentacles after that.
Well, but the Mujahideen of Afghanistan, who turned into the Taliban, basically, were able to defeat the Soviet Union and help bring down the Soviet Union as a state. They are not a force to be ignored, are they?
Oh, no, not by any sense. But on the other hand, I think that a concerted international effort, and I know that that's what Colin Powell is looking at, will go a long way towards putting a variety of pressure, not just military or covert action, but diplomatic and political as well, and even economic.
You know, what they're trying to do, I think, is to get Pakistan to essentially starve out the Afghan regime, let nothing across the border, et cetera, and provide aid to the rebels that are operating against the Taliban. In other words, we'd play in their civil war.
But that's going to be a big issue. I think that'll be the first place where we can make a difference, because right now the Pakistanis, through the ISI intelligence service, are major supporters of the Taliban, and one of the reasons is that a lot of the Kashmiri rebels are being trained in Afghanistan. So there's a certain interest there. So you're going to see that first we're going to solve the issue with the Pakistanis, and that may even end up solving the problem of Kashmir as a sideline.
So you two are on the National Security Council staff. You're sitting at the table. What do you advise? I mean, in terms of particular plans, you say, here's our plan for the first major step.
The first thing you got to do is locate bin Laden and then mount an operation to either capture him or take him out, to put it as delicately as possible.
If you can't do that, then you've got to put pressure on the Pakistanis to put pressure on the Afghans to deliver him up.
And if the Pakistanis say, we'll go only so far, we'll close the border, but we can't go any further, because if we do, radical Islamicists in our own nation will topple our government. What do we do then?
Well, then you're going to have to look for some kind of a foothold in the region. You're going to need a base of operations. If it's not Pakistan, possibly India. There's reports today that
India's friendly, of course.
Right, and even there's reports today that even the Russians are willing to provide bases from which to conduct operations.
Well, they are very worried about the Taliban, because the Taliban is disrupting the Islamic peoples and radicalizing the Islamic peoples of those southern nations that used to be part of the Soviet Union.
And there's also the issue of Chechnya. This is going to give the downside of this is that the Russians are going to interpret our war on terrorism as a green light for them to continue the scorched earth policies in Chechnya.
You know, Mort and Bill, Donald Kagan, the great military historian, was and his son, who is also a military historian teaching at West Point, just as Kagan is at Yale, were with us a few nights ago on the program. And they say full war is absolutely required, and they make a very strong and persuasive case. But with regard to the question of reluctant regimes who will not cooperate and abandon the terrorists to us, they say those regimes must be changed, and we must go in and change them if necessary. And we must not go on indulging the Vietnam disease, which they said both Powell and, for that matter, Kissinger, who no longer has direct influence or direct power, but may still have influence, suffered. That is to say that if the national public abandons you or turns against the war, then you can't prosecute the war successfully. These days, right now, it seems that the nation is indeed ready for war, far more than it may have been with regard to Vietnam. But can we count on that readiness to persist?
It's a good question. I'm not sure I know the answer to that one. I think there's a great opportunity here. There is the political will to do this. There are the resources to do it. The lingering question is, again, how do you go about doing this, and how do you measure what is victory? What equals victory?
Well, you know, if a terrorist attack on live television, I mean, this was Pearl Harbor, visible in 1941, you heard about it on the radio. And this time, you witnessed it before your very eyes. The country is aroused and ready for anything. It's a question of leadership now, and the president, I think, and the cabinet and everyone else is of a will to do it if they can figure out the strategy. And you know, I think we would do what it takes if they can figure out what it takes and in what order. I mean, those are the crucial questions. What's your strategy here, and how are you going to carry it out? Where are you going to get the bases? Where are you going to make the attacks? In what order? Et cetera. And you've got to win. You know, you've got to, you've got to motivate the public for a long campaign that you're going to have some defeats in.
I would think, too, Mort, you've got to really persuade the NATO partners beyond the formal statement of support they've given. This is your fate as well as ours.
Well, so far the Europeans have been more aggressive than we have, I think. I mean, insofar as they've arrested their Muslim fundamentalists. They just rounded them up today in a bunch of countries. Without talking about trials or niceties or civil liberties or anything like that.
Isn't it strange how permissive we have all been, that is, the United States and the West European nations, in allowing these people to get across the borders and set up their terrorist cells, and for that matter, take courses and otherwise get ready for the blows that they strike against the democratic nations?
We've been talking about a war against terrorism for years, and we've never meant it. You know, we've never conducted it as a war. It's been some sort of back burner specialty on the part of, you know, a certain kind of experts, but we've never put ourselves into a war footing about it. Now, you know, now I'm convinced that we are now going to start doing the intelligence things that we need to do. We'll probably do many of the national security things, maybe the homeland defense things. Whether the big question that we've been discussing is, are we actually ready to send troops into harm's way and lose casualties and take casualties? I mean, that has been the great worry of war planners in the United States. I think that at this moment, you've got the public ready to go.
But it means abandonment of the Powell Doctrine, doesn't it?
Yeah, by Colin Powell, among others. I mean, I think
yes.
Colin Powell still has the Powell Doctrine.
How would you enunciate the Powell Doctrine, Bill Gertz?
Well, only use overwhelming force in a traditional military sense, and really have that use of force tied very directly to a strategic national interest. In this case,
and take and sustain very few casualties.
Right. Well, that's kind of a subheading on that. Yeah, but. In this case, we're really talking about a shadow war here that involves not just military forces, but intelligence forces, clandestine operations.
Mm-hmm.
I could almost envision some type of a new counter-terrorist force that would be, as I say, somewhere between military and intelligence and covert operations that would be international and at least secret, that would be out there working the streets trying to locate and track down these terrorists.
Bill Gertz, I know you're on a deadline and you've got to get away, and we appreciate your taking time out from your heavy writing assignment. But any last thought that you want to give us before we stop for some commercials and then go forward?
I think, as I said, I think this is a great opportunity for the United States to reassert leadership in the battle, not just against terrorism, but for democracy and freedom and our fundamental values. I think it's a great chance, and I certainly hope we don't miss it.
Well, thanks very much for joining us tonight, Bill, and we look forward to seeing you again soon. Thanks
okay.
very much. And Mort, you're hanging in there, I trust.
I am.
And we're going to pause for some commercials, and then we'll be directly back. And in our last excerpt, we return to Friday night's program. Mort Kondracki here answering two important questions raised by listeners and offering his opinion on such things as the possible need to curtail some civil liberties and on the American resolve that is needed to sustain an inevitably long war. And we, in turn, go back to Mort Kondracki in Washington. There you heard it on the newscast, a repetition that
mm-hmm.
Two of the pilots who flew the planes into the buildings, I don't know whether the two who flew them into the two towers or whether this includes one the other one who flew it into the Pentagon, but that they had Saudi Air Force training.
Right. They spent time at American defense installations.
That as well. Yeah.
Learning things in the United States through the Saudis. Now, you know, so one thing that's got to happen here is that countries like Saudi Arabia, which are ostensibly allied with us, have got to be much more careful about, you know, who they're training. One thought that Saudi Arabia. You know, political dependability was one of the routes to advancement. I mean, if they don't know who their own people are, then, you know, their ability to support us is going to be limited by that much.
Mort, let's take some calls.
Okay.
And they're for you. They're not for me. I want to get your response to these. Here is the first. Hello, you're on the air.
Hey, this is John calling from Chicago.
Yes, sir.
A couple of points. One is, aside from the obvious offensive mission that might be taken on in the Middle East, I understand that in Israel they have a very low rate of hijacking and great defenses, and they have the cockpit sealed off completely during flight. And I guess above and beyond that, and taking these precautions and these military offenses, what about the Palestinians that are currently in the country here now, that have been here 2, 3, 4 years, that are waiting for that phone call in the night? I mean, how, you know, on the one extreme, you could, you know, go in the night and round everyone up, but really, what is our government doing to take a look at that threat that exists right under our very noses?
Mort, would it be fair to assume that among the Palestinian immigrants of the last 5 or 10 years, there are some, not many, but some, who are, as they say in the intelligence trade, sleepers, posted and ready to be activated when Osama or somebody else calls?
Well, Palestinians, Afghanis, immigrants from other places. I mean, I think that it requires, without being ruthless toward either the immigrant population or, heavens knows, to the Arab American population. Because incidentally, those are the people who are going to be our best spies. I mean, they are, you know, if they speak Arabic or they speak Farsi, they're going to be the kind of people we want to recruit to do the work that needs to be done. So you don't want a massive, internal security jihad against Palestinians, Muslims, or Arabs that who live in this country. But you do want internal security procedures. There's going to have to be the FBI should have been tracking these people. I'm sure it wasn't adequately because, you know, we're vulnerable and we've been vulnerable and we we haven't had adequate capacity. So it's got to start. And, you know, there's just going to have to be surveillance of and penetration of various Palestinian groups.
And what do you do when the Nation magazine and the Progressive and various other major left spokespersons in the country start shouting racial profiling, or in this case, ethnic profiling, violation of civil rights, etc.?
Well, look, there are well-known groups that are ostensibly designed to do social welfare work in the Arab American community that are linked to Hamas and other organizations. I mean, if the Nation or the Progressive magazine complains, I mean, they represent a left fringe. The American Civil Liberties Union may complain, but, you know...
And Reverend Al Sharpton will.
You're going to have to tell them tough. You know, did you see those planes going into the Twin Towers?
That's a new way to make
the
point, isn't it?
Did you see, do you realize that 2 or 3 years down the pike, there's going to be a nerve gas attack in the Chicago subway system? You know, that's what we're dealing with, and under those circumstances, you know, we've got to take precautions.
Excellently said. I couldn't agree more. And on the matter we were just discussing, here is a related question coming right up. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hello, Mort. I'm a big fan of Fox News, and it's a thrill to talk to you.
Well, thanks.
I read in Jane's Intelligence Review in the early 90s that as many as a dozen suitcase bombs had been stolen or sold by the Soviet when the Soviet Empire broke up. And my concern is that America really doesn't have the stomach for what they're about to get into, particularly if some football stadium's vaporized by one of these suitcase bombs or Lake Michigan is polluted with anthrax. I wonder if America really is ready to get into what they're going to get into, and if the government's ready for these types of internal attacks.
Well, again, I just go back to the fact that we have been attacked. You know, I mean, after we were, you know, I forget what the date was, but I believe it was in 1940. Milt, you can correct me if I'm wrong. The draft was kept going by one vote in Congress. When Pearl Harbor happened, you know, men were lining up around the blocks to join up. I think America is ready to line up around the blocks and join up at this point.
Thank you, sir, for the call. How about the Congress? At the moment, of course, they stand very strong, and they're just voting $40 billion for this effort. But we remember the phrase, summer soldiers and sunshine patriots. What if we get in there and we have some reverses and we get some serious losses? Will the Congress stand in a bipartisan way with the president?
You know, I just think that that the threat is so manifest.
Yeah.
That it's something that we understand that we have to do. It is now. I keep saying this, but I don't know how to put it any other way. It is only a matter of time until hundreds of thousands of people in the United States can be killed by a weapon of mass destruction. It's clear that these people have the intent, and they, you know, are developing the capacity. And under those circumstances, I just don't see how you can not do this.
And as we pursue them, are they likely to attempt escalation?
Of course. Of course. And, you know, and I think that that's going to be that's the threat. And, you know, it's like at every stage of the campaign against communism, there was always the possibility that, you know, we would act in one place and they would act in another, and we might lose. We kept up a 50-year sustained campaign, and we won in the end. And we knew we had to do it, and, you know, we fought about it. And sometimes we made bad mistakes. You know, MacArthur thought he could topple China by invading and make, you know, waging a land war. And we reached a stalemate in Korea. We lost the Vietnam War. We had a horrible divisive debate about Central America, but, you know, we knew we had to do this, and we did it. So if we could do that, I don't know why we can't do this when the consequences are so clear if we don't.
There is the governing class, and you report on them regularly. There's also the chattering class, and you are one of the best of that group, and you know all the rest of them. They often are proudest of seeing through things and remaining cynical and being critical. Will they, in fact, go the course?
You know, some will, some won't. Some are saying right now that the most important thing involved here is to make sure that we protect civil liberties. And I think that's something that we need to pay attention to. But it's not the most important thing. The most important thing is that we get the strategies and the personnel in place to win this thing. You know, I don't see anybody saying that this is not something that we shouldn't do. I mean, I haven't seen anybody saying the idea of a war against terrorism is wrong, that we can somehow palliate this or appease Osama bin Laden or Saddam Hussein. Now, the closest I think you're going to find people coming, and they're easily answerable. I mean, there are some people who are confused about the fact that who think that Israel is the problem, that if we somehow, mm-hmm. you know, made peace with Yasser Arafat, forced the Israelis to knuckle under and give Arafat what he wants, that somehow all of this would go away. I can see that argument being made. It is totally false.
Two prominent people have said that today in articles they have written to be found on the Internet. One is David Irving.
David Irving.
Little more to be said about that.
Right.
And guess who the other is?
I don't know.
A famous American intellectual.
Let me see. What's his name? you tell me.
Noam Chomsky.
Oh, Noam Chomsky. Well, but those are the usual suspects. I was about to say Gori Vidal. You know.
Well, he'll probably say the same too.
Right. But yeah. I mean, look. Suppose we did do that. Suppose we said to Israel, okay, we're on Arafat's side now. You give him everything you want. I mean, that would only encourage Osama bin Laden to come after us. I mean, they want us out. They want us out of Saudi Arabia. They want us out of the Persian Gulf. They want our cultural influence, which they deem to be evil, to be gone from the Islamic world. They want every Islamic country to be just like the Taliban.